This is a digital recording of the Senate's Executive Committee of January 19, 2012.
Let's see. Any agenda changes that anybody needs? Any time certains for reports to request?
Any old time.
We'll do at 3:30.
I was right here, look.
And, okay, and I think we'll get to some of the others. Yes.
And I need a time certain at 4.
It needs to be at 4?
Yeah.
He was very specific.
Wow.
Sorry.
Unless we finish early.
Not 4:02, not 3:58.
Well, I could have said 2.
Somebody else coming for that or something?
Mine, no.
Oh, I was wondering why I couldn't put it at 3:40 or 3:30.
We could do it earlier if you want.
Okay, gotcha.
No later.
Gotcha. All right. Any other changes to the agenda? Okay. That will be considered approved. So you got two sets of minutes, November 17th and December 8th. Yes.
The most crucial part of my thing is actually part of item 3, so I'll just do it.
Okay. So any issues with the minutes that were sent out, November 17th and December 8th?
I saw typos, but I didn't be careful.
Okay, let me see. I thought I had them around here somewhere.
You might want to, does anybody have those minutes?
I do.
I do. I have them. I was trying to remember if these are the ones that had the funding.
So December 8th, the academic calendar item. You want to make sure that things don't go in the minutes that you don't agree to.
Right.
Is that the December 8th one?
Yes, would you like to take a look at that?
The academic calendar?
Yeah,
all right, I think we better ask Laura to tell us what it says.
Thank you.
Margie could.
What?
Academic calendar. Read aloud to the group?
Or just...
Yeah. Okay.
It was said, but yeah. I made it a little stronger, that there was intense debate in EPC about scheduling spring break during the sunniest periods in desirable.
That was another one of those.
That was actually sort of said.
You said that, you know, and it's like...
Yeah.
But...
I we can leave that.
So we're leaving that in the agenda?
I think we should.
We shouldn't take this too seriously.
All right.
I'm sorry.
Is there a motion to approve those minutes?
So moved.
Second.
Any objection? Okay. Both sets of minutes approved. I've not received any correspondence to speak of. So a couple of things to... just briefly mention in my report, retreat last week. Thank you to almost all of you for coming to that. Some great discussions.
Are you specifically not thanking some of us?
No, somewhere there. Almost all. Somewhere there. Right?
Thank you to all of you who came.
Thank you.
She's editing your sentence structure.
That's going to be next week's funny.
Thank you to everybody who came, except Jennifer. Saying not quite everybody in the room came. And so, good discussions. Laurel's office is compiling those proposal forms that came back, and we'll talk about those next week at the academic coordinating team meeting. Thanks, Deborah. Thanks, Andrew. And we'll talk about specifics that came out of it. I'm not sure that we got as much actionable out of that as perhaps I might have hoped, but a lot of interest in figuring out how to get together and hold those kinds of conversations more. Lots of talk of informal settings and cocktail hours and such. So we'll see. Some of that's actionable, I suppose. Andrew and I and Alex Boyer will be meeting with Dan Condren and Susan Kashak soon to start reviewing proposals from consultants to be this telling our story consultant that we that they've told us is coming on board soon with the Chancellor's Office grant. So we'll have more to say about that in the next couple of months. Elizabeth Stanny has been serving as my appointee and before me, John's appointee on the University, on the Green Music Center Advisory Board, and also as chair of the University Affairs Subcommittee of the Green Music Center Advisory Board. She's had to step down because of family health concerns, so I'm going to serve in that role. Went to my first meeting last week. Different world, I must say. But we met on the Green Music Center stage, which is a fun place to hold a meeting. Maybe we'll talk about other meetings that might be held on the Green Music Center stage. But plans for the opening season are coming right along. Hopefully big announcements coming up soon. I wanted to mention one workshop that's coming up in connection with the Affordable Learning Initiative, which I hope we can get some traction on this semester and try to reduce materials costs for our students. There's a workshop next week, an online free online workshop by the Open Content, what are they called? Anyway, the folks who are organizing open education resources. This is a good opportunity for anybody who wants to start to learn what's out there in terms of cheaper but vetted materials for class use. So that's free. It's an hour a day for Monday to Friday next week. But the hour is of your choosing anytime during the day. So anybody's interested, check that out. And I think that's all I have to report. Questions for me? President Darmignan, the report.
Well, a couple of things. On January 1st, the trigger was pulled and the CSU was deducted another $100 million for in the year, fiscal year 11-12. Reductions to the CSU equals $750 million. That's over close to 30% of the $100 million trigger also became a permanent reduction to the base. As you recall, most campuses had found one-time monies to cover that reduction, basically from savings and reserves. You can only spend those once they are spent, they're gone. Therefore, now we have to figure out how to make that reduction on a permanent basis. That's $2.3 million for us. The governor also announced his budget. The budget has a number of interesting pieces. Mm-hmm. One is a flat budget, meaning that our reduction are for next year, $750 million. We don't get a dollar more, a dollar less. The governor, he spent most of his meeting yesterday in the State of the Union pushing for a series of tax increases that it most probably will make the ballot for the November election. If those tax increases are not approved by the electorate, there's a trigger of $200 million, both for the CSU and the UC. Therefore, depends on how you think it's going to happen, how the voters will go, but there is a trigger. And there's also a trigger of $4.3 billion or so to K-12, and they are automatic. The legislature doesn't go back and talks about it anymore. Boom, they happen as
that's part of the budget reduction. The governor is asking for the legislature to sort of adopt a budget with some level of reductions and some by March, and the legislature has basically said no, they will not do that, and they will not really engage in any discussions on the budget until after the May revise, and therefore the budget would not be an early budget, but it would be at best an on-time budget, if not a late budget. But remember that this budget will have to pass before the November election. So there's a lot of timing issues on that. The governor's budget also is, interestingly enough, is silent on enrollment. There's a lot of discussion about what to do about enrollment. The budget the trustees submitted included an enrollment growth of 5%. Some people argue that most of that is already in, because most campuses are over-enrolled. We are on target 103%, but that's therefore at least at this campus, 3 of the 5 is already there. A couple of other things that the governor has done for the CSU, and then I'll talk a little bit about the Cal Grants. The governor is proposing that, and this is sort of a technical matter, but so you will not be surprised. Right now, bond payments, either be general revenue bonds or GO bonds, general obligation bonds, are paid from a statewide account. Therefore, if the CSU shares, you know, the next year's payment, let's say, is $30 million, you know, when the state makes those bond payments, it pays $30 million, you know, for the CSU bonds. The governor is proposing that those payments now be accounted, the state would still provide the money, but be accounted in the CSU budget. Therefore, when you see if this goes through, a 12-13 budget versus 11-12 budget, you are going to see that our budget has increased by $30 million. And that's technically true. It doesn't mean that there's a dollar more or a dollar less, but it's how it's accounted. Now, for those who do not follow these rigorously, or those who would not like to follow it rigorously, or those who would like to use it for their own political maneuvering, it's going to, you will hear, here CSU has $30 million, $100 million more. The reality is not so. Just wanted to, you know, because you'll see that. The other is that benefits are accounted in the budget as on July 1st. But the change in benefits do not happen until January 1st, if it's a 6-month lag. And what happened is that if there is a change in benefit, not one we make, CalPERS makes those changes, the state, in normal circumstances, basically has covered that. What the governor is intending to do, this again, if it is approved, is that you will get it, the CSU will get whatever it was expected to do on July 1st. Again, I'm going to use $30 million as a number. And if the number changes on January 1st and it becomes $35 million, you eat it, the difference. Or you will always be eating the difference. And if it's less, then you reimburse it. Of course. And of course, you know, in the benefits area, I don't think we have seen reimbursements for a very long time, and nobody expected it. But again, a technical issue, but it can have not, in, you know, it'll take a year for that to take effect, but you will see that coming. On the Cal grants, and I know so there's a lot of interest in financial aid, it seems to be around things. I think what the interest should be is in the governor's proposal on Cal grants. The governor's proposal, a significant restructuring of Cal grants, where Cal grants eligibility is going to require a higher GPA and a shorten the term of how many years you can assess Cal grants from basically 6 years to 4 years.
That's a big
deal. You know, and again, that I think is going to affect the lowest income students the most because they are the ones who do that, and both on both sides. That has got very little attention at this moment, but you know, for those of you who are interested in that, you might have a better and a nicer cost to deal with. That, I think, is about where we are with it. Long ways to go. By the way, the governor did treat this time the UC and the UC, the CSU and the UC different. The UC got $90 million. They are not on a flat budget as we are. They got $90 million more to shore up their pension system. You know, the UC is now charging pension for 20 years. The UC was so overfunded in their pension system that they never charge their members for pension contributions. That has changed, and they are now in the hole. But the governor is recommending to provide them with $90 million. Previous governors, Mr. Schwarzenegger, primarily, but there are others, treated all with the CSU and the UC, at least in terms of money, the same. Be fair or not, but you can argue that, but it was the way. This time the governor did not treat. We didn't get $90 million, they did. That's all I have to say.
All right. Since we have a time certain, I'm going to do a list, and we'll come back to that after we do the first business item. So, this first item, business item number one, regarding the subsidization of Category 2 student fees for low-income students. This is coming back from the Diversity Subcommittee after the Senate. Referred an earlier version back to the subcommittee for reworking. So, Sharon, introduce. Okay. There's a copy at your place.
So, basically, the Senate Diversity Subcommittee took the recommendations, suggestions from the Senate discussion and incorporated them into this revision. And so it's actually substantially different. It's less specific than the other one had been. The other one was very specific about amount of money and who would get it and that kind of thing. And this one is a little more general to meet the request of the Senate. I tried to actually also make it a little more straightforward. So instead of, I think we had two resolve clauses before. It's been through so many iterations. But first, I just want to say a word before talking about the specifics of this, and that is in the report from the Senate chair, he talked about the affordable learning initiative that we're trying to make education more affordable for our students, and then the report the president just gave on the things like Cal grants and that kind of thing. There is clearly a squeeze on everybody in the United States, but especially in California, and around education. And unfortunately, this is really hurting the people at the bottom the most because they have the least amount of give in terms of, you know, they basically have try to cover basic needs, food, housing, and they don't have a lot of flexibility otherwise. So it's just this tries to help address that situation. I just think it's interesting. It seems to come up in every instance. I just wanted to point that out. Anyway, back to the resolution. So the resolution is trying to be very specific to recommend that the president ask the vice president for administration of finance in consultation with professional staff in ANF to find a way to address the need for subsidization of all Category 2 local student fees for all students at SSU who meet the same level of financial need as Pell Grant students. I will stop there and just try to explain the things that change. One is, it turns out that the Vice President of Administration of Finance really is the person who has the knowledge of what can be done or not done in terms of finances. The Financial Aid Office is under that division. And so that seemed like the correct person. And in fact, I actually got an email from Larry explaining some of the things that we had suggested, how they fit in with the way the state runs things. So he's got the his office has the expertise. Secondly, change is a subsidization of all Category 2 local student fees. That's Category 2 fees are local fees that are just for Sonoma State students. And the reason for that is because of the discussion in the Senate. We had initially just said $50 per semester, the reason was to be modest, to try to have something realistic, but the Senate seemed to feel strongly that it should not be a limited amount. It still might start small, but that the idea would be that we would try to help with all of these fees as we try to develop methods to do that. And those are fees, things like IRA, instruction-related activities, health fees, CAPS, counseling, psychological services. There's a variety of fees that they pay just for Sonoma State. The Cal grants are one of the things that help cover the state fees, and that doesn't sound very promising, but that's another issue which we'll have to definitely look into. Okay. Now, the other thing that came up at the Senate was, why just Pell Grant students? So we changed it to meet the same level of financial need as Pell Grant students. And it turns out that information is available for graduate students. Credential students do qualify for Pell Grants, but other graduate students don't. So this would then include Pell Grant students per se, but also anybody who meets those same financial qualifications, like graduate students, those covered by AB 540, which, according to my latest information, that's the California DREAM Act. There will be a special FAFSA-type form that they'll be filling out starting next spring, spring 13, I think. But anyway, the CSU is dealing with how to assess financial needs for those students, and then when the CSU is able to do that, we'll be able to. You know, they would also be part of this resolution. That was an issue. These are issues that were raised in the Senate and EOP students. And it says, including the identification of appropriate funding sources. For how this could be covered. And then the Senate requests that this be done by no later than May 1st, 2012. And the rationale is pretty much the same as before, except the first two paragraphs. I think the second paragraph updated the fees a little bit, because in the fall 2011 they did have a new $50 fee for CAPS. And again, when the new student center is open, they'll have another $150 per semester fee coming up. But anyway, so fix up some of that in the rationale. Basically, though, the point of the rationale, bottom line, is that we want to have a diverse student body on our campus, and we want to help the poorest students be able to come here, and also that it will help with both diversity in an economic sense, but also it turns out that many ethnically diverse students tend to be also economically low income. So it would help with ethnic diversity and that kind of thing. And then finally, basically the third, instead of trying to provide some examples to the Vice President of Administration and Finance of how this maybe could be raised, we decided to just take that out because he has the expertise, we don't. And so that's why the third resolve clause is basically just says that we ask that he identify a funding source to provide, well, at least it's he at this time, a funding source to provide a subsidy for the fees.
All right, so so questions of readiness, what are here for? Terry?
Yeah, I'm not sure this is readiness, but this request for the subsidization of all Category 2 fees, I think may have been misreading what the Senate had suggested in terms of that $50 cap, and going from $50 for the cap fee, going from $50 request to a $695 request, I don't think was what some people had in mind. Mm-hmm. But in terms of definitely readiness, I'm really concerned about the this that needs to be done by May 1st, 2012. Seems rather unspecific. Are we asking that this whole thing be done, that the president make his request by May 1st, 2012? Do we have an identification of funding sources and amounts and plan in place? And I'm not, just financial aid is my area, but I'm not convinced that saying that the meeting the same level of financial need as Pell Grant students is unambiguous, as you might like it to be, as clear as the intent might be. So.
I'm sorry, you said that the meeting the same level of financial need as Pell Grant students is ambiguous?
I'm not sure it's as unambiguous as this seems to imply. It may be. It may be that there is something that is a bright line. There are Pell Grant students and others that also have been involved with it. You can just enjoy it. It's not my area, but it does seem like there's a multiple step that we need to find a source of fees, and then we need to find it seems to be, for example, that I'm just not sure that's unambiguous. I'm not sure that that provides direction for what financial aid would need to do to implement this if a funding source is identified.
Sam?
Well, my understanding of the word subsidy is not that it be the entire amount. When a fee is subsidized, it could be 10% of it or 20% of it or 30%. My understanding of this language is that the subsidy would not apply only to the counseling fee, but to any fee, and then they could all be subsidized to some extent. But the degree to which they're subsidized is not set at 100%. So I think that's an interpretation that was not intended, nor is inherent in the choice of the word. And so I think that part is okay.
Speaking to that same thing, I think if we did add of all categories of Category 2, or subcategories of Category 2, that makes it, I think the problem people had was why that particular fee. And so if we say all, maybe subcategories, since we have category in caps right after it, but all subcategories of Category 2 would alleviate that. And
I don't think there are subcategories, there are just fees.
Fees within them.
Just take out all, maybe.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, just maybe even striking all.
Other comments?
Okay, answer.
Okay, Richard, you want to finish?
And then the other thing is, given how long it's been since we were looking at this, one thing that might be helpful in terms of moving it on the floor faster is if you just had a list of the two or three changes that you're making. I mean, you did it orally, but I know that people have a hard time focusing on the floor.
Comment, when this isn't an amendment to an old proposal.
No,
this,
I know.
This is a standalone proposal.
Right, but what I'm trying to say is, given people are going to be trying to say, what was it we were concerned about? And so I think if you said prior concerns were X, Y, and Z, these are addressed by 1, 2, and 3. And then all those that had some concern could see, was my concern addressed? And they'll spend less time asking questions and trying to remember what it was, and we'll get through it faster. So that's... it's just a suggestion. I don't think it's necessary, but it might be helpful.
I just wanted to answer Terry's question. Terry, in fact, I believe you were the one who raised the issue of graduate students.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so when I talked to Susan Gutierrez in financial aid, she was able to come up with a number of graduate students who met the same criteria as Pell Grant students, so I'm assuming that information exists. But she didn't show me any details. She just gave me a number. That's why we're talking about working with the professional staff in ANF, because they're the ones who know how all that works.
Good, thank you. Okay, so we're leaving the substance discussion to next week. Yes, mm-hmm. We all know there's plenty of it. Mm. So.
Clarification, don't we do the first reading at the Senate, or do I have to come back to the Executive Committee?
No. Oh. Next week is the Senate.
The Senate, though, the first reading is still just it's just clarification, questions, and stuff. Mm-hmm.
Major objections,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it's the substance of the matter, not what we're discussing
see,
here,
okay.
The technicality of whether it's ready for the agenda. I just want to make sure we're all on the same page. We expect a major discussion.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So anybody want to put this on the agenda, or do we just do that? I'm losing my mind here. We just do that at the end with the agenda? Is there any objection to including this on the agenda? All right. So if you don't say anything, let's make sure. All right, so let's see, Richard didn't make that time certain. So we'll go back to questions of the president, and John was on the list.
Yeah, you were talking about, for your reason as an example, $30 million for payment on bond. What's that what's the term thing up here?
Debt service.
I think it was in our school meeting, it was discussed, and maybe I misunderstood it there, but my understanding is that whatever that number is for, I guess, what is it, next year, becomes a fixed number from there forward, so that if that debt service increased to, say, $32 million the next year, we would CSU would still only get $30 million and the other $2 million, a differential would have to come out of the budget. Is that the case?
It's not clear.
It's not clear, no, I see.
Yeah. It's not clear what the, you know, up to now, it has been, you know, and the bond, the debt services changes every year,
right,
as you have new bonds and then other bonds are paid off, et cetera, so it changes. Well, it's not clear if, I think you're going to have probably at least a 1 year delay, but it should be $30 million, but if it goes to 32, the next year it will be 32.
Okay.
You're going to have to, you probably have a 1 year gap.
Okay.
Is that true only for the CSU, or is that true?
No, that's all for the UC too.
But it's not true, say, for prisons or.
I don't. The answer is I don't know that. I don't.
K-12.
I don't know that. To be honest, it's a good question.
Any other questions for the president?
Just a quick question. So you were talking about difference in benefits, and I'm not trying to give a personal story here, but I got a letter from ANF saying that $7 reimbursement I had received for a meal when I went on a business trip was a fringe benefit and was subject to Social Security and Medicare, and therefore I should have been charged 40 cents, and therefore they're going to take it out of my next paycheck. And the envelope cost 44 cents to mail it to me.
The processing cost probably $10 to $12.
Right. So is this something that's going to happen on all of our food now? We're going to get a little bit taken?
It all depends how you submit it, et cetera. Things like that are on an individual case.
But this is a new thing, though, that's happening now, because it seems new.
Yeah, that didn't used to happen.
I understand there was some issue with the controller's computer.
Oh.
And that basically things should have been done last year didn't get done for some gap, and I'm not sure why, and therefore this is to fix that.
Okay.
But it's going to cost 5 times as much to fix that, but that's what bureaucracies have to do to follow the law. Yeah, it shouldn't be, but that works. But there is an issue with when a budget was approved and all of that, and there's a gap, and things didn't get posted not by us, but by the state.
Thank you.
Any more questions? Okay. Provost Rogerson, would you like to give a report?
Yeah, sure. I mean, firstly, about classes for the spring, we've gone up to the 18-unit limit now. As of today, the average unit load is 12.89. That's last spring, it was 13.89. So we're down. We have a high body count of 8,123 students compared to last spring of 7,900.
What was that?
8,120.
Let's say headcount, not
body.
Sorry.
I just want to look at
the verses. Verses 13 point something.
Anyway, because of this ramping down of the unit load, we're well on track to coming in at under 103% annualized. We've still got 100 FTEs in hand before we would go over that target, and we don't see any way that's going to happen. We've only got about 150 contract courses to come in. We are trying to ease up to get closer to it because, of course, we get some funding if we can go up to 103. And so as of today, for instance, we're opening up political science, another 120 students are on the wait list, and we'll be able to open up a whole room for most of those students. And we're going to increase room capacity for Sociology 201. We think this might eat up just about another 15 FTEs. And the bottom line is we will come in under 103, and hopefully we can get fairly close to it. And we're also granting exceptions above 18 on a case-by-case basis. But I have to say, the president said he's had two complaints, and we probably had 5, 6 in the provost office, and I'm not hearing anything massive coming from the various schools. So I think we've done a good job of getting the word out, preparing students, and accommodating them. We've got fewer students this year, this spring, on less than 12 units than we had last spring. So we've actually done a better job of getting classes for students. Well done, everyone that's been involved. A little update on SB 1440, coming out of the provost meeting I was at. The system expects about 2,600 students to have completed community colleges degrees in the spring, eligible for transferring into the CSU. We have 5 degree transfer programs worked out, and that's the sort of scale, 2,600 transferring into 5 programs across the CSU.
And that's out of 1 million students?
Yeah. It's not a huge number.
Big hit.
And there was some disappointment expressed that the community colleges haven't moved faster to get more programs available. They've been very slow. As I say, 5 isn't very spectacular, but it's a start. The news is if a student applies to one of those programs and they're impacted, we must find a new home for them. So the CSU is committed to taking those students, even if it's not at the campus they actually apply to. So we'll be challenged by that, since we only have 5 programs to play with. The early start, an update on that. They've got very nice glossy informational flyers that will be given to all students who complete the EBT and ELM exams. So as they leave, just in case they fail, they will know that they have to take part in an early start program. We expect 17,000 students in maths and 7,000 in English. And interestingly, the campuses have been told that the messaging that should go out is to students, encouraging them to take 3-unit courses, so that remediation is possible. In other words, don't take the 1-unit courses that some campuses have put into place, like Sonoma State. So I don't know how that's going to impact us. I don't know if the students will take that message seriously, but that might also reduce the number of students doing it at Sonoma State. So we'll stay tuned for that. And finally, CSU Online is now no longer CSU Online. It's Cal State Online. Don't get too excited. Because there is a Colorado State University Online. And according to the director of Cal State Online, initially they will only focus on fully online self-support degrees, which exist today, which is about,
you thought it was about 23?
Maybe 23 across the whole CSU. None, obviously, it's a mistake. And I don't know what it means by they'll focus on them. I don't know if they're going to take them over. I don't know if they're going to market them. It's totally unclear. But the focus is on whole degree programs online through self-support. Stay tuned. Terry.
A couple of questions. First of all, was that comment about not having heard complaints from the schools and invitation? but more seriously, the petition for 18 units,
yeah.
I heard somewhere sort of informally that the system had stopped threatening to take money away for going over 103%. Not true. So are you still going to limit those to graduating seniors or spring summer graduating seniors? So if I have say a sophomore who submits one, there's just no point in signing.
We would like to still hold firm and have the message that a reduced load isn't bad. As we're going to the fall, we're going to have more students and probably less money. We haven't decided how we're going to deal with the budget cut. We will not have any more money, so we will be having to do more with less. And one thing that will help is to try and keep the unit load sensible. We don't have to hold it down to 12 again, but we certainly don't want to have a fat fall. So I think we've been successful in starting the messaging process. We can continue it with incoming freshmen, but we don't want to just suddenly relax everything to the point that we're not taking seriously. Steve.
So are you saying that it might be good to let maybe just a couple more students into our classes? I mean, I'm not suggesting we open up the doors to large numbers, but maybe, you know, if we have a couple students who are really banging on our doors, maybe it would be a good idea if we added them.
We're starting to do that. We are. If there's a real need, yep. And there are seats, yes. Absolutely. John?
I was having a conversation with somebody from Student Affairs, and they were actually, they had not heard it from me, but they were sort of surprised that Academic Affairs was getting so few complaints because they were actually getting a lot of complaints. And it wasn't around so much students not being able to get enough units as they were getting units, but they weren't necessarily the courses that they needed. And I just wondered if Matthew or Paul could speak to that, maybe.
The only thing I've heard so far from the advising, and I remember I kind of get a handle on the undeclared students, and they kind of get a handle on them. We are the advisor. That is my school. and EOP students, is it seems like some of those students are the ones that are being impacted. I think the classes that you opened up at the over break, those 300 really took a lot of that out. So, John, I don't know when you had that conversation with the student affairs person, but right now we're in communication with Laurie and our enrollment management group looking at some of our EOP students and some of our undeclared that haven't been able to get a lot of them are at 11. So how do we leverage it? Could be some of the folks that are banging down your door or a few people that are talking to Terry. And I am also not inviting you to call. I've only had two, just like the provost, I only had two parents that actually ended up calling me and saying, hey, what can we do? What are those things?
Yeah, just to comment on that, I think the students kind of are in a tough situation in that aspect, in that, you know, for so many reasons you need the units, whether it's I need to be able to live in the dorms, I need to be able to go to class, I need to be able to pay my insurance, whatever it is. And so you need to take the units, but it's not necessarily the class you're looking for. And now we as the university is looking to, has used the wait list really effectively in the last semester and a half or so, to be able to find the need for those classes that are impacted so that you shouldn't necessarily be signing up for those classes you don't need just to have the units. But it's a change in culture for students, because before it was anything that's human you can humanly possibly get into, you have to get into to be able to stay in school. And so if faculty and, you know, if we all could do a good job of trying to preach that change and say that, look, academic affairs has an eye on these classes, and so just because there's a waitlist of 60 doesn't necessarily mean you're not getting in anymore. That means we'll probably be adding classes to that need. And so I think that problem definitely exists, and I hope that as the waitlist becomes more a part of our lives, I guess, that culture will change a little bit for students. But it's been really tough in the beginning. I get a lot of that also is, like, yeah, I've got 12 units, but I've only got really one class that's going to be my, that's going to count towards what I'm trying to do. And it's unfortunate, but it's, again, I think it's kind of a symptom of us changing strategies here a little bit.
Okay, I had a couple of things. Math was one of the first transfer degrees approved, so I assume we're one of the programs that some people are now transferring into. Do you know if we have any way of knowing whether these incoming students are coming in with a transfer degree? Or have no idea of how we would know that?
I believe we do an application process. You actually check. I think I'm mentor that you're one of these students.
This ASP 1440?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it still comes from the CSU. There are thousands of students in the community college system that have said they're doing right. And so the first step has been to look through the list of people who claim to be in this program and then define the ones that really seem to be ready to graduate with this appropriate degree that will transfer in. And so they're sending out letters to the 2,600 they feel are legitimate. I would imagine, based on the response to those letters, that we'll get more information about who might be coming. But at this point, they're just trying to do a validation. It's a mess, and the community colleges don't seem to understand that students really have to finish the degree and then transfer in. That's a change of culture. They could do 70 units and just transfer in and do whatever. But to be in this situation of 60 plus 60, they have to be in the program, finish the degree, and then transfer into one of these five majors.
Okay, and then the other question was, could you describe the professional development piece? A call recently went out to faculty for...
Yeah, sorry. We put out a call for six faculty from the campus who would be willing to put on a two-hour workshop on some practical aspect of teaching with technology. And we're paying $500 per faculty member. It's just a kind of one-off workshop, so we're waiting to hear from this one. There might be someone in education illustrating the advantages of e-portfolio, for instance. We don't know yet. Waiting on the response.
Thanks.
I was just wondering if you knew what some of the other transfer degrees that are approved are. Do you happen to know?
I tried to find Elaine before I came into this meeting because I knew someone was going to ask me. Mathematics. I think psychology is one. Most of the degrees that we have transfer agreements for are impacted. Mm. So that's where the panic's coming from, because I'm not sure that we will be able to find a hold for some of these students. But I will get that information to you,
Sam. Yes, Richard.
Responding to that earlier issue about the caps and things, I've already seen, having had some conversations with my chair, that the wait lists are making it easier for us to understand which of those courses are problematic, and we're able to connect the dots in ways that we didn't used to.
Right.
So, for instance, we're seeing that certain upper division courses, people can't get into them because they haven't got the prereqs for it. And so now we can offer an extra section of the prereqs. So I think we're going to get some rational shifting of offerings that'll be another step. Instead of less reactive, we can actually be proactive in the future semesters. So I think that's going to really help us get toward the path of getting them through with fewer just hold space courses.
All right. Anything more for the provost? Terry.
I've got first a question for you in terms of your major. How many units is it? How many units does your degree require?
Depends.
We have several tracks. I mean, we have a
BS,
a BA.
What's the maximum number?
50.
Total overall
units. Five, one of them, but most of them about 52.
No, it's going to be 120 or more.
Well, just in our major.
I'm not asking about your major. I'm asking overall. How many units is your degree?
Oh, all of us are doable at 120.
They're all doable at 120.
Okay. Mine's 124, and that's another thing that hasn't been addressed in this thing. Is there's language in there about high unit majors, but nobody's ever defined what that meant or how we're going to deal with it. Mm-hmm. So at least in our major, if we're going to be held to that no more than 60 units, we have to be able to identify them so we know that those aren't 124 unit students. 120 unit students, you can't ask them.
At the moment, you are allowed to be in it. I mean, one reason you can say we cannot comply is because the major is over 120. Kinesiology, for instance, the Chancellor's Office accepts that that one will not work because it's higher than 120. Be aware, and President Armagnano knows this, that Chancellor Reed is looking and will be looking very hard at anything over 120. He wants all degrees to be 120 in the future. But for now, he would be okay.
Unless you have an accreditation issue, you know, right? But these things that, you know, increased knowledge is not enough of a reason.
We now have a brand new website that it's just come online that you can look at every degree across the entire CSU. You can see every university that runs those particular degrees. You can see how many units are in every degree. And that was the Chancellor Reed's request, and one reason is he wants to see how many are above.
Mm-hmm. So I guess we'll have to cut out one of the count.
Mm-hmm. You don't need to count.
Yeah, like
organizational material. All right. So, Armand, was your time certain request for your report or for the business item?
For both.
Well, which one do you want to start?
I'd like to start with the business item.
Okay, let's do that now. Business item two.
EPC took your comments to heart. We listened. We made what we thought were defensible changes to the, basically the I think the difficulty in the first meeting was the fact that the guidelines seems a little bit out of sync with the actuality. So we went back and discussed that. So this is what we came up with. And you can see the following page has the changes we made tracked.
So, let's see. Richard?
So I see in item 7 that there's a comparative closer. Closer than what? Or was that just meant to be close to the middle of the semester? Closer than in previous years. Okay. So do we want to just have it, if it's standing and not looking back, we just say close to the middle of the semester, yeah, 2 weeks?
I have the same exact question.
Yeah, you could take out the R on closer.
Mm-hmm. So I have a procedural question for the whole group, because I was talking to the faculty about the academic calendar and that we're working on a new academic calendar, and it just has to do with and everybody just take a deep breath before you shout it. Okay?
Everybody just take a deep breath.
It has to do with the way this campus gets faculty input on the calendar. Or do we... I'll just leave it at that. That the 4-week break that we had was very short. I'm looking at all these other breaks and I was doing some quick math. They're not any longer. And so my faculty is just as stressed as when they left, with issues still carrying on. And they're not happy with the thought that the breaks are going to be that short and the input that they have on the calendar. So if that's the way it is, I can hear that. I'll take the message back. But I'm just wondering, is that the way it is on this campus? That we don't put it out for a vote. We've never thought about putting it out for a vote. Help me understand some things to take back to them about this.
Well, our practice is that the Senate approves the guidelines for the calendar. The guidelines are implemented every year by Academic Affairs, puts together the calendar in accordance with the guidelines and presents them as an information item to the Senate. The Senate is the body of faculty that has input on that kind of thing. We've certainly never talked about having a faculty-wide vote on a calendar, anything like that. But the guidelines right now, this is the time when we get to have input on about that.
So those are up for...
That's what we're talking about right now.
Passion.
Yeah.
I say. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I was just carrying a message back that I didn't have an answer to. So. Okay.
Yeah.
I'll start.
Terry.
So several questions. The first would be to the point raised earlier, that's closer. If we're just looking at this as a prospective document moving forward, why don't you just say that spring break will fall in either week 8, 9, or 10? But now for my list. Scattershotting this. So the item number 4, so we're applying the time between the end of final week and the end of semester is the week following finals week and the end of the semester is always on a Thursday, because it seems like that's what the 24th would imply if we have final week no later than the 18th. Maybe I miscounted days. Maybe it should start better. There's nothing here about the start of the fall semester. Do we not care about when? That kind of is Deborah's point. There's things about when it needs to end and how long that minimum time for that winter break and implied sometime about when spring is to start.
Can I just address that? Because if you look at the notes on the proposed academic calendar, it tells you the number of minimum instruction a day. So that's what's driving it. I mean, you can make a pronouncement that fall semester shall always begin on the X Tuesday of August following the full moon in July. But I think the drivers are in the notes. And that has to do not only with academic year instructional requirements, but also work day requirements for other professions.
On
the back of the calendar.
But again, that's sort of, you can work backwards, but for example, if somebody decides to take up that point of wanting a longer winter break again, but still having pressure from the chancellor's office not to start later in January, to start the semester earlier in August. And I don't. And you didn't mention whether it was what the modified Gregorian calendar. But anyway, could we do that? Could we start at the 1st of August? Could somebody decide we're going to start the 1st of August if we have a longer winter break?
According to these guidelines, yes.
Exactly. There are trade-offs, right? It's not shorter because, I guess that's kind of it.
Richard, so remember we're trying to decide whether this is ready for Senate discussion, so any, big issues that you think are going to be stumbling blocks are appropriate to bring up now. Richard?
Actually, I'm going to defer.
Jennifer?
I pass, thanks.
Sam?
Can I make a comment on the calendar itself or not?
If it seems inconsistent.
In terms of readiness?
Errors?
There's just two times, Friday to Friday is only 6 days.
Yeah, in 2012, Friday is December 21st.
Not the 20th, like it
not
says.
The
20th. Okay.
In 2013, it's the 20th, not the 18th.
Okay, thank you.
This isn't really specific to readiness, but just in terms of what it might be good that someone could address if this goes to the Senate. Does anybody have any sense, or is there any way to get any preliminary data on how the intersession went this time? Do we know?
I taught.
Good.
It was stressful.
It's kind of like, I would imagine we're going to get at least some questions about keeping it at 3 weeks like this, maximum of 3 weeks, no shorter than 21 days. People will have questions about that.
I'll find it. Yeah, I've actually got that right in my office. It was more successful than I thought it was going to be.
And that can always change. But
I think we could probably get the data in terms of how many sections were offered, how many students took it, whatever
exactly.
It was produced. But what we don't know is, would they do it again? Because like Sam said, it's stressful. And some people think, I do this and they never want to. So maybe students that don't want to take it, and maybe faculty don't want to teach it again. But anyway, that's kind of the problem with the one-time
test.
Experiment.
Right.
Yeah. Can I make one comment?
Yeah.
Department-wise, we did have lower enrollment in our intersession courses than in the past. There was definitely that effect.
Yeah, Dean Merrickle told me it was half across the board,
yeah.
The old game, half as many courses, half as many students.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It definitely had that effect.
So that's more than I expected, too. But, okay, so comments on readiness. Are we good to go? I want to point out that the minimum length of winter break, I guess I had a question about what the end of that meant. It clarifies the front of that to be the last day of finals, but it doesn't make it clear whether the end of winter break refers to the faculty retreat day or the beginning of instruction day, and that makes a difference. So if it refers to the beginning of instruction, then for instance next year's calendar, it would meet the guidelines to start instruction on Monday, January 7th. In other words, 21 days is 3 weeks.
Yep.
We had 4 weeks this break. And so if we thought this was short, the guidelines as they're currently written allow even a week shorter.
Mm.
If the end of winter break refers to instruction. So that's something, Armand, that I think needs to...
Well, the chair did guide us to provide some language regarding winter break. We wanted to provide language that specified a minimum to allow for flexibility rather than to specify, you know, what day of the week they'll shall retreat mm-hmm. fall on, because you know, we're not looking at calendars beyond 2016 here anyway, and we're going to have to revise the guidelines accordingly anyway when we get closer to that year. And some of us around this table may not be around this table at that time and may have other thoughts.
Perhaps, but there's no requirement to revisit the guidelines when 2015 comes around. Right. So.
But we have a calendar that will allow for faculty retreat on the dates that you see in the proposed calendar. So the guidelines are just there for the purpose of this 5-year calendar cycle,
Ben. No, that's not right.
Not for eternity, because we're revising guidelines from the last 5-year calendar cycle.
No, these guidelines are the standing guidelines. They're not in reference to a particular 5-year calendar. And so whatever guidelines the Senate approves, it needs to be happy with applying going forward.
And what would you propose instead of 21 days?
If people want to propose a longer minimum in there, you know, 24 or something like that, to ensure that there's 4 weeks from the end of finals to the beginning of instruction in the spring semester, then somebody could make that proposal. I just want to point out the guidelines would allow even a shorter winter break than we have this year. Carrie?
Would it suggest addressing this for a couple of reasons by redefining winter break to start following the end of the semester rather than the end of finals week? Because that sort of implies that,
so grading that.
I don't need to, you know, if I don't get my, if I have a Friday final assigned to me by the university at 4:00 in the afternoon, I don't have to grade my final exams until the next semester starts because I'm off the winter break. But we also know that then goes... requirements of administration admissions records in terms of having the process grades to get reports.
But if you do it that way, then these calendars will be incorrect because you will have the end of the semester plus 21 days will be a much longer period of time, especially in 2015 and 2014. So I think that you're going to run into some serious problems if you change that phrase from exam week to semester.
So let's see.
So let me then reiterate a concern from the point of view of the department chair, of the academic calendar guidelines suggesting that winter break begins when finals week is over.
Let me just jump with a response to say we don't really need to refer to winter break at all. We can just say there will be 4 weeks with no classes scheduled between the end of finals week and the beginning of instruction in the spring semester.
That would address my concern.
Margie.
I was actually going to say these are the kinds of things that are going to come up in the Senate anyway. So in terms of actual readiness, if we're agreed that this is internally consistent, you don't mind taking this forward to the Senate and having these issues brought forward in the Senate, I think that, in other words, we don't like that it looks like this, but that's not the same as saying it's not ready to go forward.
I agree.
Fair enough.
So I would move that this go forward.
Second. Okay. We okay to, well, people still want to talk about it. All right. So, Steve?
Yeah. Days when you're grading finals are not days in the calendar. And this is a very important issue for lecturers, because lecturers who collect unemployment over the break, the end of their employment is the last day of finals. That comes from the contingency clause in our employment letters, which makes us eligible for unemployment, that we're only paid for the days that we are in class. We're not paid to grade finals. Okay. And so that shouldn't be part of the calendar. So, you know, the break should begin at the end of finals.
So I'm just wondering, is the possibility to talk about a longer break or changing it to August 1st? Or if we're saying it's ready to go on, you know, on to the Senate, does that mean that discussion here is dead in the water?
Well, like, it's not what we talk about.
Okay.
We're not in the executive committee, and I
okay.
tried to point out what I thought were issues, but of course let us get into trying to fix them as well. So so I just want to make sure that the people who are presenting it, which in this case is probably Armand, are ready for the kinds of things that are likely to come up. Let's see, Sam, Deborah.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out to support what Chair Ford said. If you look at the legislative history, there's generally been 6 years between approving the guidelines, even though it's a five-year calendar. So these guidelines theoretically could go on for 10, 15 years before we decide to revise them again. There's no requirement that we revise them every 5 years. But I just had one question about item three. It's not a big deal, but what's gained by changing from the Thanksgiving break shall consist of the following days to saying it consists of those? I mean, what was the motivation for that change, do you know?
Unnecessary word.
Okay. All right.
All right. So there's a motion to put this on the agenda, and it's been seconded. Is there any objection? Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Skip Deborah.
That's all right. So just a question again from my naivete is there a date? Is there something not being said that there's a date by which we, and should it be on this before it goes to the Senate, about when we should end? It says the commencement should be in May, but is there an end time that you guys have discussed that I don't know about?
Well, I wanted to anticipate, because in a sense we're coming back to your original question. In the past, Reuben has been whacked around by Charlie, and we are one of the few campuses that came in as late as we did. And so the whole thing was moved because the pressure was coming down from above. So in terms of does the faculty voice really matter on this one, I think this was one of those pick your battles kinds of things that happened before, and these are just the sequelae from it. It's not the end of the year that mattered to us. It's that Charlie didn't want us starting late in January. We were the second latest starting campus, or latest, I can't remember. Yeah, and so we were moving up to middle of the pack so as not to be out there to be picked at for yet another thing. And so that's the stuff that wasn't being talked about. And so now we're just rolling with all the
fallout.
Effects, yeah. So.
Thank you.
I understand for faculty it was a really short break, but this is actually something students pushed really hard for a long time. It is really tough for a student to go and be off for that long and then to be able to turn it back on and then to come back so late or to end so late. If you're a student who's going home for summer, all the summer jobs are gone. If you're graduating, you're graduating 2-3 weeks after the rest of your colleagues who are graduating. And so a lot of the employment opportunities have sailed. And from a student life perspective, it's great to have some of that continuity. I mean, this year for the students, I would say the energy is so much higher than going on almost summer break. I mean, we had, it was 8 weeks for a while there. And I mean, you just check out of school forever. And to be able to come back, it takes a long time to get going again. And I understand that it was shorter, and for faculty, it's much shorter than for students who after finals we check out and come back on the first day of school. But it really is something the students have pushed hard for and will continue to push hard for. I think we really have enjoyed, I think intersession was the biggest question mark for students, and most of the input I've heard from students over intersession was, it wasn't as bad as you thought it was going to be. And so I would say, I mean, this is something that is really important to students and really makes a big difference in our world, both on campus, programmatically, student life-wise, and for after we graduate, it makes a big, big difference.
All right, so...
I need to say that on the Senate floor.
We seconded to put it on the agenda. Is there any objection?
No.
All right, so this will be on next week's Senate agenda.
Good luck, Armand. Are you back at Father?
I have no stake in the outcome. I'm a messenger boy. So anyway, the Mayan calendar says...
Don't even bring that up.
Armand, did you want to continue with a report?
Yes, I'd like to make a report. It's going to be really brief, but first of all, we did meet with Lauren Morimoto and follow up on the off-campus testing policy, and we've directed the Athletic Advisory Committee to come up with a draft of that policy, which we'll then share with FSAC and APC. So SAC. I'm still a little bit getting used to these acronyms. I know I've only been in this job for 6 months. So we did have a chance to meet with her and discuss that, and I'm hoping that she'll come to an early meeting this spring so that we can begin moving forward, so that we could possibly have a policy in place in time for this spring athletic season.
Wow.
We also, we did the calendar. We've talked about over the last few months the program review subcommittee, and it is underway, and it has started meeting, and our representative, Amy Kittlestrom, has said that they are actually going to complete the UKIA program review from 2008.
I don't know. It might be 2008. That's a long time ago.
So that's going to happen. We have a new item coming up from GE, a consent item for our calendar next week, which is going to be the introduction of Econ 205, which is a microeconomics course to category D1 in the GE curriculum. That was passed unanimously by GE subcommittee, and so it'll go as a consent item to us, and I guess as an information item to you. Not even an information item.
Consent
item to you. That's the report.
All right. Any questions for Armand? All right. Thank you. So let's do the last business item and then see what we get to the reports. So faculty eligible for emeritus status. So this is second to last page in there. There are two just retired faculty members on that list. First of all, are there any issues with including those two on the list that goes to the Senate? Okay,
so FSAC reviewed a request at the request of the chair. We have a colleague who is terminating her teaching, but but because she's technically required, triggered something that didn't easily match the exact language of the policy. And so she was technically already retired, but she from another CSU, so therefore she cannot retire from the CSU, and was no longer teaching, has done the 10 years service here, and so couldn't automatically end up on the list. FSAC's recommendation, which will be coming as a letter to the chair this week, so that it could be a communication before the meeting, recommends that that she be added to the list as an emeritus instructor. So I don't know if I need to go any further into that. Is that, but it's looking at it categorically, so anybody who was in her kind of circumstance, having done the 10 years here, which is our main criterion, but also at the end of the teaching, not going on to get a job somewhere else, whatever she's finishing. So we were saying, okay, for the sake of the policy, we consider that in effect a retirement from the CSU system. So we would recommend she be nominated.
So the current, the SSU policy on emeritus status says a faculty member who retires from SSU having completed at least 10 years of service shall be eligible for emeritus status. The hang-up in this case is that this faculty member is not technically retiring from SSU.
Right, is not permitted to retire.
It's not the 10 years of service that's at issue, it's the technically retiring versus terminating service.
Yeah.
And so I asked FSAC to evaluate whether that situation met the intent of the policy. My understanding is they're determining that it does, recommending that it does. Terry?
But the person is retired from the CSU.
Yes, from another campus.
Right. From another campus. But then came and did more than 10 years here.
Okay.
My understanding is if someone retired from the CSU, they would not be able to work full-time here at Sonoma State. And my understanding of service is it's full-time service.
No.
It's not? You could teach one course a semester and 10 years service?
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't get you service credit on this when you get the little things. So.
You don't get your pen?
No. That wouldn't get him a pen, right?
So the criterion by counting years of service, whatever is being used for everybody else, if it were applied to this case, she would count. So
is there a different service for our service awards? That's different?
That's not the issue.
Okay, yeah,
all right.
Right. So we're saying the way that it's counted for everybody else, if applied to this person, she's met it.
Okay.
So
my question is, this person is faculty?
Yes, she's a lecturer, long-time lecturer.
This person nuts?
She's a retired annuitant. That we hired.
Rehired.
Rehired
annuitant.
Yes.
Yeah.
For less than 1,000 hours a year.
And the main concern, really, to think about is, are we setting any precedent we don't want to live with? And we didn't see that by doing this, because the case is so unusual. If we use the same criteria in the future, it's unlikely we're going to get somebody else. And if we do, I doubt we would not want to give them. It doesn't open up anything else like, are there exceptions to 10 years and all the rest of it? And so we thought we're willing to live with the precedent that this kind of a decision would open up.
Okay, please beg the indulgence of the committee for one more nit to pick.
Okay.
Someone who had not retired, who was only teaching one course for a semester, would not be able to retire in 10 years. So it is different. I don't think you could retire in 10 years from here if you only taught one course a semester.
Yes.
Can you?
Yeah, you can.
Is that true? Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I have a faculty that did that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
It is weird. It's definitely archaic.
Okay. Okay. All right.
Okay. So I'm hearing no objection to my including the person in question
on this list.
Are we just going to write the person in question on the list?
So in that case, what's her last name?
Madeline Rose,
yeah. From sociology.
Because we intentionally kept her name out of this because we wanted it by the criteria so that there wasn't any personality issue going in it. Now that it's decided on, it's okay to.
I've always wondered about that. Can you say no?
Be- Because actually, we have lots and lots of letters of support just waiting, and all these people going, we're going to fight this. Let's not make it personal. Let's just make it a process.
Sounds great.
Yeah. Okay. Move to approve. Or whatever.
So any objection to including faculty eligible for emeritus on next week's agenda?
No.
Okay. So let's get into more reports. I want to quick note, neither of the statewide senators are here because the statewide senate is meeting. There was a big brouhaha at the end of last semester when the statewide senate's budget was cut. Mm-hmm. There was a meeting yesterday or the day before between the chair of the statewide senate and the faculty trustee and a couple other people and the chancellor and executive vice provost. And anyway, people like that. And the chancellor's office has made an offer of a larger budget going forward than this year's budget, and hopefully it's enough to keep the statewide senate functioning, and we'll hear more about that, I'm sure, when Catherine and Brian are back.
But the augmentation is for the 2012-13 year,
right,
not for this semester.
Right.
So this semester they would still be in the hole.
Okay, so that's all the news I know from the statewide senate. Charlotte Kirscher, do you have anything to report?
I do not. Instruction functions has not met yet.
Matthew, tell us what's up in your world.
Sure. I'll give you a little. The provost did get to talk too much about what we're looking like for the students coming in, because we're always functioning on trying to recruit them right now. We're actually sending out letters to students accepting them into Sonoma State. We have just about 1,000 more applicants than we had last year. So again, we continue to grow that pool of folks that want to come and get a great education from all of us here. We're about 1,000 more letters of acceptance ahead of where we were last year. The difference is that we are targeting a higher index for students, so trying to recruit the students that are the best students that we can get to come here. So the enrollment management group, the provost, as well as the deans and others, we've worked on trying to look at matriculation activities, letters to those students that we want, particularly low-enrolled majors, again, but just really trying to look at the quality students that we can get to come to Sonoma State. So I think we're doing well. We have about 300 more transfer applicants than we had the year before, so our transfer pool continues to be strong. And then our PBACs, because they just are trickling in and it's very individualized, they're a little bit up from where we were last year. Another good note, we have 57 international student applications compared to 35 last year. So that's another one of those diversifying activities. So other than that, we're really trying to keep an eye, and the provost and the teams that we've assembled and all the deans and all of you have worked very, very hard to get students units and use the wait list to make sure those bottlenecks and other things. I appreciate data-driven decisions to look at prerequisites and then what the students need to get in versus waiting till someone screams in one of our offices. And I've only really had two parents and students come in my office with regard to not being able to get the courses that they needed or wanted. And it was a little bit of that, I didn't get the course at 10 a.m. that I wanted, therefore you have failed. So we've solved some of those problems. But other than that, the other good news is that we had put a hold on all searches for a while because of the budget, and the president today gave me the permission to restart the MCC search. So we've already had candidates that were selected, and we're going to try to bring those to campus as soon as we can. The advisory board met today, but I was in a cabinet meeting, so I wasn't there. And we're trying to figure out how we patchwork together, probably with some volunteers being in the center to try to keep it open. Gina Geck, who was doing it on top of her normal workload, it just is not a sustainable model, and we weren't doing what we need to do. So Dr. Hess, myself, Gustavo, and other professional staff will probably be volunteering. time there, doing office hours. So any of you who are interested in, we have computers in offices that if you felt like it was something appropriate and you wanted to support, we'd love your support until we get a full-time hired person there, and we may be making that call at different venues across the campus.
Sam? I just was wondering, you know, this unit cap at 16, and it sounds like, you know, that's great, people can take 16, but since we don't all have all four unit classes, the reality is, you know, a student could be stuck at 13 and they can't add that four unit class because it takes them to 17 or whatever the case would be. I was wondering if it'd be possible to have a cap where you say, as soon as you add a course that takes you above X, then you're done. So, for example, you could say the cap's at 15, but you could be at 14 and add a four-unit class and get to 18, and then you're done because you crossed the line or something. So, you know what I mean? Instead of making an actual cap, making it a, once you pass the line, you're, I don't know. Anyway, it's just an idea.
Yeah. It's actually 18 now. Yeah.
Right, I know, right. But whenever...
That's actually a good idea. I thought about that.
We're still playing with the system and trying to figure out what the capabilities are and trying not to make sure we have to hand enter all. It was a challenge trying to get all those double appointments in, but I think it's some of the right way to do to spread the resources and also get us the information back to all of us to do the planning. But that's a really good idea. Yeah.
I think you'd have to still have a bracket. I mean, I could envision somebody going up, say, let's say the cap is 16, going up to 15, then adding a five-unit chemistry.
Well, maybe
course.
You'd have to.
I mean, so you might have a bracket.
A hard limit.
You can go over, but not to exceed.
Right, right.
Type of thing. A bracket. What's that?
The price is right.
I'm not sure whether this is a question for you or for you or maybe even somebody in CMS. And I apologize because I don't have hard data in front of me on this, but this came up in the context of a conversation because we have some experimental courses that we're running in social sciences right now, including some teen talk courses and things like that. And
I saw a poster session on one of those.
Yeah, you did. but anyway, the word has apparently come out, and I believe it's out of admissions and records, that they would like to stop accepting experimental courses as substitutes for major requirements. The reason being that we've been told, in a way, because it's too hard to handle in CMS. And I just kind of wanted to run a flag up the pole here and say, if you really want to kill curricular innovation, that's a great way to do it. Because we've been using experimental courses for donkey's years to figure out where majors needed to go. That's a technical term. Archaeologists can use that. Since DIRT, we have been doing this. And it's a mechanism for innovating with your major and your curriculum in a way that lets you test whether that's going to be a good idea or not before you actually change the major. So I guess my question is, can you help me get a clearer, can somebody help me get straight information on this? Where is this coming from? What's going on? And secondly, if it really is an issue where it just doesn't fit, it fits crosswise into the CMS hopper, we have to have a workaround for this. That doesn't mean somebody's sitting there hand-entering all this stuff. There's got to be a way to make this work.
I will call you and see you one extra, because I am going to be very cranky with my staff if they are all of a sudden wading into curricular and academic design. Because first of all, I'd say they have no business saying anything except this is difficult because of the hand input and we need to solve it so we don't stand in the way of exactly what you just said.
Right.
So that's my first comment to start this with. So
let me see if I can find out where this exactly came from and why we got the information that we did. I just know it's all over social sciences right now, and people ask me to bring it forward. So.
No, I appreciate you letting me know that, because it's really inappropriate for my staff to be talking to faculty and saying, you know, we really don't want to have to do the matriculation work of this class counting for this and the senior
it's
level.
It's the degree progress reports. I mean, they've been chronically problematic for everybody, so, and I understand that. But.
And we're rolling out the new student, in the summer, so hopefully
right.
Some of those things will,
right. That'll be great.
Will work, and I think it's just us working with each other more closely as we do experimental classes and are looking at innovation. How do we make sure we're all talking so it doesn't come like, oh my God, it's this semester and they're graduating and I forgot to get this clearance
right.
into the system,
right. Exactly.
Those kinds of things. So I think it's a process.
Great, thank
Dr.
you.
Dr. Purser, but I will do everything I can to ensure that they no longer are talking about things they maybe shouldn't talk about.
Or didn't know that we were even talking about.
One subject back, we were talking about unit caps and whatnot. And a couple years ago, I think it might have been you directed me to some people at CMS to talk about whether or not you could switch from, instead of using a unit cap, using a class cap. So say, okay, yeah, you only get two classes or three classes.
Right.
Because the only reason students speak in units is because the university speaks in units.
Right.
And really, the difficulty with our past thing has been what's the right number, because we want them to have two courses or three courses, and you've got five units, and
majors are different.
A couple years ago, CMS said no can do. There's been a couple of rehashes of the PeopleSoft system since then, and there's another one coming. Is that technology around or on the horizon?
We have the technology.
Yeah, I'm clearly not the computer science guy, but
okay. It
doesn't seem like it'd be done.
We'd just be locked in, I think.
That'd probably be a Jason question back to Jason and the CMS team. I know enough to make myself dangerous about it, and that's about it. I'm happy to take that forward. And that's a good point, as we have, as Sam pointed out, we have classes from one units to five with labs, and
right.
And we're really trying to figure out how we spread our resources around and how we do that in the most fair and equitable way as possible. So I think all these are good things for us to maybe kick around in the CMS team and see what we can do.
I mean, we're talking a lot about caps. I mean, I'm hoping there isn't going to be a cap in the fall. I'm hoping there's just going to be a change of the way we do business and the way we advise students in an ideal world, and a slight change in culture that we really keep our students on track to graduation without imposing these caps. I'm not at all sure we have a cap in there. We did the capping only because the spring was dire. We had to get it below 103.
And all will be less. A thousand more apps, a thousand more letters of acceptance.
All right. Let's see. So,
and may I say one last?
Yes,
thing?
Go ahead.
I went to the faculty retreat, and it was excellent. Even for those of you like Jennifer who might or might not have attended.
She was there.
I did see her there, so I will vouch for her.
I might not have been welcome.
But Dr. Ford and Provost and then the rest of you that participated, it was well done, and it created a lot of great conversations and synergies around us working together and trying to figure out some difficult problems. So I just want to say, well,
all right, thanks. Glad everybody appreciated Andrew's participation since he wasn't there.
One follow up on that. There were about 40 classes being taught in intersession, and none of those faculty could attend the retreat because the finals were on that day. I just wondered if there's any way we could try to adjust the calendar. So,
well, we did that on purpose.
No, that was the retreat was scheduled long before they decided to add the intersession, and then I was not on the ball enough to. I mean, I did meet with them, and I got them to get them to end on Thursday instead of Friday.
Thank you.
And that was probably during the time when I thought the retreat was on Friday. So we'll do what we can to work that out in the future. I didn't like that myself. Armand already gave his report. Richard, do you have an answer?
Just a couple things. We're still chasing down, trying to see if we can take what's currently the interim textbook adoption policy that came out under Eduardo's aegis and just get the interim off of it with as little tweaking as possible. The things driving it are accessibility to help with DSS, get the material in time, but the other ones are there are certain students that need to get the information early so that they can get money from other agencies to buy the books, as well as give students chances to look around. And I think trying to get something simple, but thinking about ATI and the Affordable Learning Initiative in there, but not specific language about those programs in it so that it doesn't slow us down. Just try and get that coming through as quickly as possible. You'll probably be seeing a message come out fairly soon from the SETI task force at FSAC's getting started, inviting some faculty to come in and help work with it. We've got three folks who are going to start chasing this. And it's opening up the bigger question of, how do we want to use SETIs? What should be in them? It was triggered by the requests that came in for the diversity stuff, but we realized that
as we heard before, open the can of worms. So this will be a long, steady plod. We'll be doing that. And I guess that's that.
Questions for Richard?
A lot of our last one was dealing with the emeritus issue, too. So that was it.
Okay. Jennifer.
Yeah, we haven't met yet, but we will be talking about that student election code, that pesky student election code. We have a draft of something that SAC has worked up in collaboration with some people on Associated Students, and we're sending that around to the advisory, if I haven't, us. And so it's coming. It's in the works. It took a long time.
Thanks. Any questions for Jennifer? All right. John has a...
Yeah, real short. And now, CFA and CSU management are meeting today at a neutral site in Long Beach for the first mediated session on the CFA-CSU management collective bargaining agreement. Mediation is the process when the two sides are unable to progress in negotiations and the neutral third party comes in to see if they can get both sides talking about the issues again. CFA requested help from the mediator in November and CSU managers agreed to the request. And anyway, just want to say CFA is committed to using the process to reach a fair contract. That has not changed. This is just another way to get that contract. We hope that CSU management is equally committed to successful mediation.
All right. Thank you. If you have questions for Andy, email him.
That's right.
Paul.
We're back. like it or not. No. Believe it or not, it's almost election season for us again. We're halfway there through our terms, but elections take place in, I want to say, like a month or something like that. And so packets have gone out or are available already. They're online. If you all could help us send your best and brightest, and we are planning a huge recruiting effort to try to spruce up some of the races this year. Last year, a lot of the candidate races got overshadowed by other elections that were taking place that had fees and buildings attached to them.
Like Voldemort?
Yeah.
That's what we should call the race.
Totally what I'm calling the race.
but really, packets are available for elections. If you all could help us get the word out, there'll be a big recruitment push for this year. It's really important for us and for student governments and for AS as the business side also that we have good solid people in for the years to come. We have a lot of people. We had a lot of people come back this year. Those people are now graduating for the most part. So we're in need of some good people.
John.
So all your positions are just 1 year positions, correct?
Yes.
And I know last year when I said you changed the names of a number of the positions. Where'd be an easy place to get access? So if we want to recommend students like particular positions.
That's a great question. So our website, which is sonoma.edu/AS, then there's a student government link, has all of that stuff. That's where they can get the packet. That's where they can find out, read about kind of all the position descriptions and all of that. Also, if you want to send them my way, I'd be more than happy to meet and direct them and or send them upstairs to the in the student union. There'd be plenty of happy people waiting to point them in the right direction.
Is there an org chart in there anywhere?
I believe that's a good question.
Because that's a real fast way to help find.
Especially an up-to-date org chart.
Yeah.
I'll double check. That's a good question.
Very cool.
Thank you.
I'd like to express my appreciation to Paul and all the other students who came to the retreat.
Yes. That was so cool.
We had lots of discussions at the constituency that sometimes look around the university and say, why aren't they at the table? So thank you for coming.
If Paul's done, I actually have another question. He mentioned elections. What's the status of, oh,
I was supposed to read my notes.
Oh.
Let's see. So nominations so far. One nomination for secretary, two for at-large senator, one for URTP. Do we just need one?
Me too.
Need two for URTP. One for lecturer, senator, none for chair-elect, and none for the at-large member of the Senate Budget Subcommittee.
But actually what I was asking about was the change to the Constitution.
Yes.
We're
planning to do it this spring, with the election.
That's what I was asking.
So we'll do the constitutional election with the candidate election, with the proviso that there will be a date by which, you know, a closing date. If it needs to be extended to get to the 50% necessary for the constitutional vote, only the constitutional vote gets extended, not the candidate.
Okay. So the candidate doesn't know what they're running for.
So they could be in limbo.
Yeah.
So that one position will be vote for this person for chair-elect. Note this person will be vice-chair if the constitutional amendment passes.
Thank you.
It's not
a different
question.
Okay,
Richard. One thing, I've been talking with a few other folks about this when we saw several of the searches freeze, and your comment about the MCC is what prompted it for me. And I mentioned some of this to you, Andrew, before, just the idea that if we have some searches on hold, it would be nice if the committees that hadn't met yet had organizational meetings and would earmark times in their calendars so that if we turn them on, they actually can run as fast as possible. And I don't know if that's gotten up there, but
the search for the science and technology dean has been headed by Barbara Butler, but
yeah.
She's got back from a vacation, and that committee will meet ahead of February 1, and then that's one that Ruben said will go ahead things of February 1.
But for instance, I know that I was elected to the chief information officer or whatever one,
yeah.
And so that it better not have met because I wasn't there and never heard about it.
Richard,
yeah, but even if all we do is meet and just block off our thing, and
make sure that happens.
Yeah, and I understand if we can't search them, you know, it's crazy times, but okay.
All right, on to the agenda for next week. Let's take your packet. Have you done anything to change what's printed here?
Finished the disruptive student behavior policy.
Oh, right,
so
right.
The diversity subcommittee resolution will be added to what's here. Anything else that anybody sees need to change?
Oh, just point of information. That'll be a first reading for the
Yes.
Okay.
Two second readings, two first readings. Take the question mark off.
Yep.
Okay. Everybody want to move to next week's agenda?
Move.
Second.
Any objection? All right. We're good to go. Thank you. Next week, we're adjourned.
All right. Thank you.